Very distinguished Lucy Bethbridge, a journalist and a regular contributor to The Albany, and has written brilliant books, including Servants, A Downstairs View of 20th Century Britain, and her new book, which she's going to talk about today, Tourists, How the British Went Abroad to Find Themselves, was reviewed by another of our speakers, the great A.N. Wilson. And without hardly knowing each other at all, A.N. Andrew gave a very objective review, saying of Lucy that she is a percipient social observer and a deep thinker. She has read everything there is to read on the subject of early British tourism. So, Lucy Bethbridge.
Thank you very much, Harry. And yes, indeed, that was an absolutely fantastic review from Andrew in The Oldie, and I was delighted with it, of course. Very kind of him to say I've read everything there is to read, because there is so much to read that I tipped the iceberg. There's an awful lot more. There are travel diaries, there's a wealth of literature about holidays abroad that this book just touches on. But having done my book on servants, I had spent years studying domestic labour, and it occurred to me that the great changes in everyday life also happen in leisure moments, that I wanted to look at holidays, the idea of which, of course, is a very recent one. In the 18th century, you only knew what a holiday was if you were a working man, and the holiday was your holy day, it was your day off, your feast day from labour. And if you weren't a working man, you didn't do any work at all, so of course you didn't know what leisure was because you were a person of leisure. So I began this look at the growth in group holidays, in what we might think of as group jollies abroad, in 1815, when the Napoleonic Wars came to an end with the Battle of Waterloo, and the continent was suddenly opened up to the middle classes for the first time in about 20 years. I ended it in the 1970s in this sort of hermetically sealed world of the sun and sea holiday, the beach resort. But in the interim, I think, over that 150 years, the great changes in the way that we travel and go abroad and take our annual 2 weeks of holiday reflects the enormous changes that have happened in the world of the middle classes. So the history of 19th and 20th century tourism is the history, really, of the Industrial Revolution. It is about work, and changes in work, about a new kind of routined, timetabled work, and about breaks from a kind of rhythm. And in the 19th century, they were very interested in the idea that actually the new urban world of work, of offices and bureaucracies and, you know, clerkly penmanship, work was a kind of a rot. It actually physically made you ill. And so the notion that you would have a break from this became not only the idea of pleasure, but the idea of actually of healing. It is also the history of factories and conveyor belts and mass production, of souvenirs, trinkets, food, cultures, the amount of stuff. And I think what we see in the 19th century is the world packaged for us. And the great titans of tourism did that packaging. Thomas Cook, of course, with his, you know, package tour, in which people were taken on group holidays in which they had to make no decisions for themselves. The sights they were to see, the food they were to eat, the hotels they were to stay in. Albert Smith, who was a huge showman, climbed Mont Blanc and then came back with these, what we would now think of as sort of full immersive entertainments, by which, again, he took an adventure that was possible for the people who went to watch him in his great sort of shows in Piccadilly. He called it the Alps in a box, and it was a kind of packaging of experience. And that, I think, that packaging of experience gives us the holiday that we understand now, the touristic experience. Of course, as that experience becomes increasingly dominant all over the world, people in search of the new, the special, the unique, find themselves having to go further and further afield. So the, as it were, the person who thinks of himself as a traveller is constantly in retreat from the tourist hordes. But it's interesting how tourism and tourists are described by 19th century commentators, particularly, in these very dehumanising terms as swarms, flocks, hordes, herds. Because, of course, the distinguished soul traveller is never a tourist. But it was Evelyn Waugh who said, the tourist is the other fellow. You know, one is always the more discerning traveller. But just to have a look at what the industry of tourism created in this sort of amalgamation of stuff, I'd like to read you a quotation from an American journalist who went to Iceland. This is a time in the 1850s when Iceland was just opening up. The first Murray's Guide to Iceland was published in 1853. But before that, there were no hotels, there were no roads. It really was off the beaten track. And this is an American account of a group of English tourists setting out for a trip to the interior, taking with them patent tents, sheets, bedsteads, mattresses and medicine boxes, guns in handsome gun cases and compasses and chronometers and pocket editions of the poets. They had portable kitchens packed in tin boxes which they emptied out but never could get in again, comprising a general assortment of pots, pans, kettles, skillets, frying pans, knives and forks and pepper casters, demijohns of brandy and kegs of port wine, baskets of bottled porter and a dozen of champagne, vinegar by the gallon and French mustard in patent pots, collodion for healing bruises and mosquito nets for keeping out snakes. They had oil lamps and shaving apparatus and nail brushes and cold cream and dentifrice and patent preparations for the removal of dandruff, lint and splints for mending broken legs. One of them carried a theodolite for drawing inaccessible mountains within a reasonable distance. Another a photographic apparatus for taking likenesses of the natives and securing facsimiles of the wild beasts. And on it goes. These vast touristical industries that spread across the world. And before long, by about 1860, you could get all these equipments in Reykjavik, which before this had not even had a shop. It was virtually a barter economy. But before long, there was a Thomas Cook representative, a hotel, a place where you could buy Pringles thermal socks. And of course, now, Iceland is not off the beaten track at all. In fact, I noticed that it's among the top destinations for hen and stag weekends. So I suppose the conclusion that one has to come to, that while tourism preserves cultures, which it does in a kind of aspect, it preserves artisanal crafts, for example, but only to create pointless, useless trinkets for tourists. But it also kills the thing it seeks. Wherever it goes, it brings a kind of death in life with it. And as we have seen over COVID, whole economies supported by tourism, when that rug is taken away, are completely emptied of life. And so I finished with the line from Dr. Johnson, who said that we travel in order to regulate imagination with reality. And I think the truth is that now, with the world that is so available to us on the screen and so well travelled and so industrialised by tourism, we actually travel to regulate reality with imagination. Yeah.